The spacecraft Hawkwind was found by Captain R.M. Calvert at the Society Astronomy, an international guild of creative artists dedicated in eternity to the discovery and demonstration of extraterrestrial intelligence, on the 8th of July, 1971, in the vicinity of Mare Liberum, near the South Pole. The discovery of the Hawkwind has led to more wild speculation than any of the mysteries of space that we have so far encountered. The facts surrounding the discovery of this drifting, two-dimensional spaceship have been so distorted by guesswork and rumor that any further attempts at assessment would only increase the density of the fog. The following extracts from the ship's log are presented without commentary for the reader to form his own conclusions. They would appear to be the work of a collective robo-scribe, although one or two of the entries might possibly have been made by the hand of a single unassisted crew member whose identity still remains unknown. We hope this amazing document will stimulate scientists, mystics, occultists, policemen, and all children everywhere.
And so ends the first entry in the Hawkwind logbook written by the great Robert Calvert that accompanied the release of In Search of Space, the second Hawkwind album. Yes, Hawkwind are back with a vengeance, and we are back with a vengeance. Technicians of Spaceship Earth, this is Hawk Binge, your journey through the astral plane that is the Hawkwind discography, one album at a time, in the company of a long-term fan, which would be me, and a first-time listener, which would be Matt. How you doing, Matt?
I'm good, thank you, Andy. Happy New Year.
And to you.
I found myself back on the East Coast now. I'm back in New York, where I belonged, after spending the holiday season in Portland, which is no less cold. So I have been enjoying the fact that I can stay in and avoid the minus 12 temperatures which are outside right now, and, you know, just warm myself with the comforting vibes of Hawkwind.
Indeed, yes, I only have to put up with the traditional grey mist and sleet of a British winter. But Hawkwind, nonetheless, entertaining at this point in lockdown. While you've been putting that on back-to-back and giving it repeated listens, have you managed to squeeze anything else into your playlist?
I have. I've been listening to a band which I found walking through the newly reopened Rough Trade Records in New York. I was looking for something to check out. I just happened to be passing, and this album on the PA was just so whimsical and really sparse and intricate at the same time. I had to just run up to the cashier and ask them what it was. And it was the new album by a band called The North Americans, which are on Third Man Records. The album itself is called Roped In. It's an instrumental duo who make really liberal use of pedal steel guitars and just put loads of dreamy reverb and tape delay effects on it. The recording is so well done. You can just hear every scrape and strum, so the instruments sound really close to you, and you just feel the human interaction with the instrument. But at the same time, every single note just fades into this really interesting, rich, textural vibe to just kind of swim around, and every single note they play just adds to it. And it's really difficult to pick a track, because sometimes, you know, our ambient music is just designed to be in the background, but this one makes for very rewarding listening. I'm not a big meditator, but I've certainly put it on just to listen to and just really spend just 40 minutes blissing out, which has been really nice, especially when the snow started to fall while I was listening to it. I thought it was very, very appropriate. But the track that I'm going to add to our playlist is called Greetings from a Distant Friend.
Very nice. That sounds amazing. And what about anything else?
I've been going through some of my lists of albums which I missed in 2020, and one of the ones which I didn't catch when it came out was Heaven to a Tortured Mind by Eve Tumor. He's a very interesting character himself. He's very ambiguous. He's been on this big mission to remove any of his backstory, gender, sexuality, everything from his music. So he's just trying to be a musical being and just not have any connection with the actual creator, and just try and let the music speak for itself. And for me, it really does. He's one of the very few people who I really feel can make a guitar sing. Every single note is just beautifully constructed. It feels like a real performance. The album's got lots of really great spacey grooves. The track which I've been having on repeat, and we'll be adding to our playlist, is a track called Kerosene, which was done in collaboration with another singer called Diana Gordon, and they just work really, really well together. It's got the guitar solo, the harmonies, absolutely everything. As soon as that track finishes, I just play it again. So yeah, been really enjoying that.
Nice, sounds good.
How about you, Andy? What have you been checking out?
I've found myself going back into the comfort of very, very familiar territory in the last couple of weeks. And I started to play some Bauhaus, which is just always soul music for me. Not soul music for anybody else, perhaps. Not soul music, actually. But definitely good for the soul, put it that way. And in particular, their second album, Mask, which has some outstanding songs on it. The Passion of Lovers, Hair of the Dog, Kick in the Eye. I think it's Bauhaus at their best in the early 80s on Beggar's Banquet. And Kick in the Eye is definitely the one that sticks in the mind that's going to go onto the Hawkbinch playlist. And then the second one is, I found so much of the music I play is very dense, not necessarily heavy, although a lot of it is, but very dense in the kind of soundscape mode. And it tends to go into more negative emotional territory, foreboding kind of ominous music, which is usually it's my stock in trade. And in fact, my last two picks on the last episode were in that kind of a vein. And I needed something much, much lighter and more airy, basically, to be a bit of a companion these last several weeks in this lockdown situation. So I went back into jazz, basically, into kind of 50s, 60s jazz, which I don't do very often. I haven't got an extensive library of jazz, but I've got some music in there which I really do like. So some Miles Davis or Ornette Coleman. So free jazz. There's definitely a time in my life when I would have said that the worst possible thing you could ask four musicians to do would be to improvise at the same time. But actually, I kind of learned to get into it and got it. And I got through Miles Davis into some of his electric period and got into that around the time of, say, Bitches Brew and On the Corner and things like that. And jazz fusion, in fact. And I never thought I would have developed an appreciation for jazz fusion. But that's what lockdown has done to me. In fact, I'm wondering now if maybe I've had COVID and actually one of the symptoms of COVID is an appreciation for jazz fusion.
They do say that one of the symptoms of COVID is a lack of taste.
You could be right. All of this rather long-winded story actually is that my second pick is not one of those albums at all. It's actually Hot Rats by Frank Zappa, which kind of has these jazzy elements to it. And is a work of genius. Frank is a genius. I saw him twice, actually, in 1988 on the Broadway The Hard Way tour. And definitely the only time in my life I've been properly starstruck, because obviously in the 80s, there's no internet. And Frank was never mainstream. So you never saw him. You never saw him in the press. You never saw pictures of him, videos of him. So I was standing at the front of the stage, just kind of slack-jawed gawping at Frank Zappa. And Hot Rats is a classic, 1969, mainly instrumental. And track one is quite possibly the most joyous opening track on any album, Peaches on Regalia. So that you will find on the Hawkbinch Sessions playlist on Spotify, which will be coming, I believe, after the next album review. Is that right, Matt?
I think so. I think we'll have about enough to justify calling it a playlist, which people could start to follow. And we will be sharing that in episode 3.
Outstanding.
Yeah, never thought we'd get this far, which is awesome.
So, exactly.
How many? Only 300 albums to go?
Yes, I think, exactly. Like we're definitely on the home straight. It's a very long home straight, that's all.
So talking about the previous episodes as we were, interesting enough, I got a text from my dad, who I did not tell I was doing a podcast until we did it. But he mentioned that he really appreciated when we were talking about all the amazing releases in 1970. And he said that he was 19 that year and was earning regular money for the first time, which is why he has amassed such a large collection of 1970s vinyl, which is something that I started to grow up listening to. So it's interesting that it's kind of come full circle that I've started now talking about the stuff which he's now been fondly reminiscing about.
Well, that's pretty epic. And 1971 just continues that trend. But before we get back into 1971, we have a bit of an announcement and a bit of a plea to make, because the Black Heart music venue in London, which is very close to our Black Hearts, is in some trouble. There is a message on a site called Crowdfunder, which says, "Friends, we are in serious trouble."
Anyone who listened to episode 0 for us knows that we are really big fans of live music, of the kind of desert scene, the kind of stuff that Hawkwind definitely helped to form all the way back in the 70s. and the Black Heart has always been very close to us, and their little upstairs venue is one of the founding venues for the Desert Fests, which we've been going to all the time and just really enjoy going and just checking out whatever they're putting on. They always do a fantastic show. They've spent the last year adapting their bar and venue to meet all the guidelines, but as they always change, they found that they can go no further on their own. They've basically spent all their contingencies, and to keep going or risk the prospect of never reopening, they are trying to raise £150,000 by the end of March. Their landlord hasn't been able to help them, the government hasn't been able to help them, so they're asking really as a last ditch. They're not just doing this in a kind of pleading way. They do have prizes, which they're doing every week. So it's a kind of giving lottery where anyone who gives has a chance to win some cool stuff. If you want to go and help, do check out ourblackheart.com. All the details and ways to give are on there.
Yeah, it's really quite heartbreaking. There are so many tragic stories, both for individuals and businesses and places that we all love, that arise from the pandemic. It's pretty hard to find space for any more than everybody's currently dealing with. But we lost the Crowbar in 2020 in London. The Borderline closed its doors in 2019. These places are really under threat, and they are the beating heart of the London music scene. So if you are one of those people who is fortunate enough to be in a position to help and contribute, then please do. And now it's time to get in the time machine and dive back into 1971. Okay, Matt, so you'll remember from 1970 that it was just an eye-wateringly good year for the kind of bands that we would be interested in. And you were talking about your dad and remembering back that far. Well, 1971 is a ridiculous, ridiculous year. I was actually finding it very hard not to just laugh all the way through putting this list together of the albums that are released in 1971. It's quite extensive, so bear with me here. We get Led Zeppelin 4, so Stairway to Heaven, the bane of guitar shop owners from then on in. Who's Next, arguably their best album. The groundbreaking Marvin Gaye album What's Going On. There's a riot going on, apparently, for Sly and the Family Stone. LA Woman from The Doors. Sticky Fingers from The Stones. The amazing Tapestry album from Carole King. Bowie releases Hunky Dory. Jethro Tull release Aqualung. Maggot Brain comes out from Funkadelic. Pink Floyd released Metal, which is really them hitting their groove before Dark Side of the Moon. Yes released both the Yes album and Fragile. You get Nursery Crime from Genesis, Fireball from Deep Purple, Tarkus from Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Islands from King Crimson. This is an insane year. And Don McLean releases American Pie, so we can say bye-bye to that one. So it's just something as amazing is happening at this point, that all of these bands are at their absolute creative peak, all at the same time. That 1971, that's just quite epic in terms of bands releasing their best material.
Absolutely. I think it really helps define the start of the 70s as this time of rampant experimentation.
Totally. There's one more story from 1971 that I wanted to relay. I was looking through just a site of stories, music stories that arise from 1971. And there's one here that I felt compelled to read out. The background to this is in 1969, 4 months after Woodstock was held, there was another free festival held at Altamont Speedway in San Francisco, which was headlined by The Stones and Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, all those kind of bands were there. And the story is, this is quite hotly contested, but the story is, and it's a good one if it's true, the Rolling Stones management hired the Hells Angels to be security for the concert for the payment of $500 worth of beer. Now, if you unpack that sentence, there's a lot wrong with it. And it did end up going horrifically pear-shaped. It descended 300,000 people. It descended into violence and several people died, including a woman called Meredith Hunter, who was stabbed apparently by one of the Hells Angels. So fast forward to 1971, and this is the story. February the 16th, Alan Passaro of the Hells Angels, who was acquitted on January the 19th of the stabbing death of Meredith Hunter at the Altamont Speedway in 1969, files a lawsuit against the Rolling Stones for invasion of privacy because their documentary film Gimme Shelter showed the stabbing. There's so much about that I can't quite get my head round. But, you know, it does show that for all of our year of absolute craziness in the news, 'twas ever thus, perhaps.
Yeah, new world, same humans, unfortunately.
Yes, well put. So moving on from these dark times into the Hawkwind camp in 1971, as the gang move into the studios to record In Search of Space. And that gang has some changes. And this will be a familiar story, basically, of the round table of Hawkwind alumni. So out of the band go John Harrison, who was the bass player on the first album, and Hugh Lloyd Langton, the lead guitarist, who, as I said last time round, he will come back and be a very large figure in Hawkwind lore about 10 years down the line. But he's gone. He's not replaced with another guitarist. So you'll hear more of the saxophone and occasional flute of Nick Turner in this album. And it kind of says to me that Hawkwind don't have a particular template. They just seem to record with whoever seems to be around at the time. And the music they come out with is the music that that group creates. So those guys are gone. Into the band comes Del Detmar on synthesizers, which obviously they're then diving deeper into the world of electronics. And Dave Anderson replaces John Harrison on bass. Returning are Dick Mick with the audio generator, his engineering skills, Terry Ollis on the drums, which feature pretty prominently here, and the creative leaders, really, of the band, Dave Brock and Nick Turner. The album is co-produced by Hawkwind and a guy called George and I can't pronounce his second name. It begins with C-H-K, and I have no idea what to do with that. C-H-K-I-A-N-T-Z. He's also in the studio for albums by Blind Faith and King Crimson, some Led Zeppelin, The Stones. He doesn't necessarily produce those albums, but he's an engineer. He's around. So a man who knows what he's doing. In Search of Space comes out on the 8th of October 1971 on United Artists, and it reaches number 18 in the charts, which, looking at the rest of the albums that are coming out in 1971, that is quite a staggering feat. And obviously, I think number 18 on the charts back then, you probably had to sell a whole lot more than you do to be number 18 on the charts now. So that's quite substantial. And this is the only Hawkwind album to go gold. The only gold album Hawkwind ever got is this one. And that was really surprising when I read that. I had no idea that that was going to happen. So that is the production of In Search of Space. To go with the album, there is also the logbook that we mentioned earlier that Matt read from, which is written by Robert Calvert, and also some pretty interesting packaging by one Barney Bubbles, who another figure who looms large. So that's the album. That's the background. That is the lay of the land in 1971. It's now time to find out what Matt thought of this album. I've got to put my cards on the table. It's one of my favorites. Here's Matt's hot take.
Well, Andy, I don't think you're going to be too disappointed with me tonight, because this, for me, is an album. I feel they said that they were past this when they did their first album. I wondered how past it they were. It turns out they were past it by a lot. There's an awful lot to like in this album for me. Just looking at it from even just before you even put it on, I love the art. It looks like a kind of Space Force logo. America should have had a look at this before they started to make their own. You know, there's something kind of like nice and official, but also just bright and fun. The stars all around it. This strange lady with rainbow ears, or whatever it is that's going on, hidden slightly behind the all-seeing eye triangle, some weird Illuminati stuff going on. There is a huge amount to unpack, but it looks, compared to the first album artwork, which, to be honest, looked like it had just been pulled off the fridge and a child had drawn it, in my opinion. I wasn't particularly impressed with it. Just, it looks professional. It looks like the kind of band that I would expect to go, oh, that's a band. You know, before, I feel like everything had that amateur edge to it. This just feels like massively, massively advanced. The one thing which I did find weird was just the album name, In Search of Space. I just read that and instantly thought, look up. Like, it's there. Like, finding things in space is hard, but finding space itself is normally not the hard part. So I thought the name was a bit weird. But beyond that, I think it's really great. I think There are some things that infuriate me slightly. I feel that still Hawkwind can't leave enough alone with their own tracks for me to fully enjoy them. But on the whole, it's much more accomplished. I listened to it more times than probably I needed to do this podcast, so I was actually very much enjoying myself. There were some parts of it which I hope they maybe move a little bit further away from, but there are parts they land where I'm very glad that they did. I still feel like they don't consider quite the album journey. Like, for me, the album just kind of ends in a puff of nothing, which is, again, a shame given how much I feel like their intros have really improved and really suck you in. So that's kind of an annoyance. But in general, the album itself has been actually a real pleasure.
Well, that is excellent news. Sigh of relief all round, I think. If you'd come up blank on this one, then I think the subsequent 32 albums were going to be something of a struggle.
Yeah, I don't want it to be a podcast where I just beat up on a band I've never heard before, but no, this is genuinely, it's been really interesting to go through.
It's interesting that you refer to the first album and that we're past this statement that they made off the back of that first album, because this does feel like an entire package with the logbook, with the artwork, with the way it all fits together. There's no theme in the music, but conceptually, the whole thing does seem to gel as a whole.
Yes, I feel like they apologise too much for knowing their first album was weird. They're like, let's throw in all this other stuff. But I also feel like, again, the first album was about them exploring what space rock meant. And I almost feel like this album has an excitement that they feel like they have it. Like some of the bands that I'm a huge fan of, like Gorillaz. And I always appreciate when bands start to think about the whole experience of listening around to it. So despite me feeling like they might have gone off a little bit the deep end compared to their first album, I do massively appreciate all the efforts that they've done to do that.
Outstanding. Well, let's get into this then. And the first track on the album, You Shouldn't Do That, their longest track at about 15 minutes, Matt.
So this for me is an intro track. I feel like I was at a gig, all the lights are off, the track starts to play before any of the band walk on, then they do, and everyone starts to clap. You know, you just feel like you've got this energy to it, and there's a lot of suspense, which is really nice. I don't know what synthesizers they're using, but they sound just rich and gooey. They sound fun, very atmospheric. I really enjoyed that. They've discovered risers for sure. There's a lot of, like, you know, before the first track breaks, there's that kind of thing where you have a note which is very low and just slowly goes up. For me, it's like, I call this the boiling kettle riser, because it really gets quite screamy at the end before the whole thing turns into a full track. It's interesting because I know that they don't show up for another like 15 years or so, but I almost felt like this could be like an early Chemical Brothers record because of all the pianging and synthy like weirdness on the top, but also like there's something quite repetitious about this. It just feels like contemporary dance music. It feels very live. There's a lot of space in the track, you know, there's a lot of separation. It feels like it wasn't recorded with too much studio production. It does still have that kind of feeling of the first album. The weird thing for me is that the synthesizers feel almost artificial and really in your head, where the actual rest of the track feels far away, like you're listening to it from the other side of the room. So there's something interesting there where it just feels like it's been put on top later, or the mastering feels sometimes a little bit confusing. But it does have that kind of like busk rock thing. Like you said, it goes on for a long time. I think that it's maybe a little bit of a victim of its length, a little bit. And this is something that I feel like in the whole album, there's bits where I feel like they have a solid riff or a solid point, you know, like at the beginning they established it. And then sometimes it'll kind of, for me, I use this phrase, like it feels like it wanders off. Like there's a riff and stuff, and then like that riff will simmer down, and then I know there's like flutes and saxophones, and they're very processed, so they feel quite muffled, and it doesn't feel like a solo. It just kind of feels like they're just like murmuring over the top of it. I found myself losing concentration, because I almost felt like the band was almost losing concentration. Like there were little bits where they just have little smatterings of bits of sound all over the place, and then suddenly it would pull back, and I kind of felt like I'd been pulled back again. Like, oh no, yes, I'm paying attention to this, sorry. And it was just weird that happens quite a lot in this track. For me, I would have liked it if there was a little bit more presence in the saxophones and that kind of thing, just to try and make it feel like it was more of a solo, or it was something that was adding interest rather than, unfortunately, kind of taking away. The lyrics I actually quite enjoyed. I like this kind of trick they have, and I didn't catch this on the first listen, but on subsequent listens, the fact they have that repetition of get nowhere, which turns to get no air, which turns to get aware. There's that nice feeling of a line transforming. And although the lyrics don't seem to make a huge amount of sense, I just thought that was clever. And as someone who occasionally pretends to write for a living, I thought that was, I was professionally impressed with that little bit of linguistic artistry.
Nice. And that is the voice of Nick Turner, of course, who we didn't hear at all on the first album, basically, but who does do a lot of the vocals on this one. Yeah, I'm with you. It's a strong opener. It couldn't be anywhere else on this album but the first track. And I do love the drone, the almost tribal element of it. This is not a rock track with a 4-4 backbeat. And that kind of sound isn't really present on any of these other legendary albums that we heard about earlier on in 1971. This feels like a very Hawkwind thing. I think that's very strong. Rhythm section's very strong here. They do tread water a little bit in longer tracks. You're absolutely right, and that's not the first or the last time that they do it, even on this album. So it's a strong one to start with, and it goes into something now in a very different mood when we get to You Know You're Only Dreaming.
Which for me feels very like proto-Desert Fest psych, just in terms of the vocal tones. This for me is probably their most vocally sophisticated song. I feel like a lot of their other lyrics and singing isn't always as in tune as it could be, but this feels very considered. It has a nice like lilt to it. I feel like it's actually being sung. For me, it's just super catchy. I like the You're Only Dreaming repetitive line is really nice. I love the jam it just breaks down into. This for me is where I thought space rock might go. It's kind of where I hoped it would go. And while the rest of the tracks make me feel that's not necessarily where it is all the time, I like the fact it can still get here. And I hope that there's a bit more of that in the future. I really like the fact that the drummer taps out the quarter beats on the cymbal. It helps you ground the track. Just having that little ting, 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 ting. Interestingly enough, it's also why I like certain techno records, because they can get very growly and bassy and mumbly in terms of a lot of their sound palette. But you normally have a hi-hat or something which is just tick, 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 ticking away. And it's just amazing for me just to help just ground myself when I listen. So it's just interesting to draw a parallel there between very dark techno and this 70s psyche stuff. I like that there's lots of delay that just creates this nice atmospheric bed. It might be why I like the North Americans and why I added that to the playlist. It's the same kind of feeling where the notes start to just smear into a whole other experience, which it just then rests on nicely. It creates a nice foundation. I'd have liked to have a return to the chorus at some point because I like it so much, but I just listen to the track twice and then I'm happy. So
that's fair.
For me as well, it even ends well, which again is something that I'm still dinging Hawkwind a lot with, but this one finishes not in a kind of, oh, we're done with it. It actually feels like it just floats off and I'm left feeling like that just, you know, that kind of thing when you eat a good bit of food or you drink a bit of wine, that kind of finish. I have this kind of mental audio finish of this track where I feel like that's a nice clean track and I find myself smiling all the way through it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right, this is Dave Brock's strongest vocal. We've heard him sing two songs before, and this is the third kind of full vocal we hear from Dave, and definitely is the strongest. It's funny, I would never have picked that up if we weren't listening to these albums in sequence. Because if you don't listen to them in sequence, it's just another song that Dave sings, and he sings a lot of them. But yeah, it does definitely show some growth there. I really do like it, and it's a really good mood change, and a great closer for side one. Which then leads us into side two and the appearance of a Goliath of a Hawkwind track, which is Master of the Universe.
So I've been listening to these in as much of a bubble as I can. Unfortunately, I caught that this was the starred track on the album before I was able to turn that off. But even listening to it without that knowledge, you feel like this is the track which you can feel like cements Hawkwind more. It's... again, probably it's the most solid track. I feel like the from the riff to the just the drum pattern to everything, it's all very well put together. Weirdly enough, listening to it now, I feel like it almost feels derivative, even though I know that it happened before. And I think that's just because so many bands now sound like this. It's not actually the track which impresses me the most. I guess this is probably more effective when it was released.
It's it's kind of the definitive Hawkwind track, I think, way more so than Silver Machine, which obviously we're going to come to in a future bonus episode. As you say, it did cement the band. And there's a lot going on here, I think, in the fact that it's actually the first Hawkwind track really to be overtly kind of cosmic in terms of its theme and its lyrics. You look at them and you just think of them so much as a kind of cosmic sci-fi spacey band. But this is the first one that really takes that into the lyrics, which is something they do a lot from here on in. It's a great impact. The bass on this, I think, is fantastic. It's actually a simple bass riff, but it's just the impact of it is beautiful. It's such a rhythm track. And again, Nick sings it. Love that. One of my favorite Hawkwind tracks. I know what you mean. When you hear something which began a movement, and there's so much progress in that movement in the subsequent years, if when you go back to it, it's perhaps doesn't have the same level of impact on you as it would have done if you'd heard it isolated without the knowledge of where it ends up. But this one definitely has a big impact on me. It's the most easily accessible track on the album, which is probably why when I first heard this, when I picked the album up, would have been in the late 80s, I would say, maybe the mid 80s. It would have been the one that got to me first, because back then I probably was less likely to like things like You Shouldn't Do That or Adjust Me, which comes a little bit later. Wasn't quite prepared for that kind of stuff. But Master of the Universe, definitely a big impact. And in fact, was used in some car adverts. You mentioned in the first introductory episode that we did that you thought you'd recognized Silver Machine because you'd seen it in some car ads. But actually, that wasn't Silver Machine. It was Master of the Universe, which was in a Ford ad. And that is truly bizarre to me, because I cannot listen to this track and think adverts of any kind whatsoever. But it's the one that they played most live as an encore when I started to see them. I very rarely heard them do Silver Machine until a bit more recently, and can be a bit of a barnstormer live. It changes a little bit in tone as different lineups play it. But yeah, this is quite a landmark, I think, for Hawkwind.
I like the fact that you waited until the podcast recording to call me out on my misremembering of Hawkwind advert tracks. Thanks for that.
I've saved us from a deluge on Twitter, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, like I said, I think it's formulaic is rude. I don't mean that. It's solid. You know, it is exactly, I can see it being a crowd pleaser. And I listen to it and I'm like, yeah, it's cool. Like you said, because so many then bands pick up on this. I'm pretty sure if you just over distorted this track, it would sound like several tracks I've heard on other albums from someone called, you know, Alien Acid or Mammoth Destroyer or, you know, something like that. So I feel like you said, with the bass, just that kind of like plod along, then go down a note, up a note and then back. You're like, yeah, cool. Absolutely. Just head nod away. We're all good. So yeah, I don't not like it. It's just interesting just to hear it and just be kind of like, oh yeah, that sounds like less good stuff than I've been hearing recently. But it's just that thing of just now listening back is always an interesting bit of dissonance that you get between the fact that you know it's old and then the fact that you're listening to this kind of stuff as well. I feel like this track, interestingly, suffers from some of the track one I'm just calling process instrument babble. I have this same problem where I find it hard to engage with from beginning to the end completely. But yeah, in general, it's cool. I like the flanger on it, actually, just to add some distortion in the second half of the track. That just feels a very nice 70s way of just adding some interest and just adding some heaviness. But again, it sounds spacey, which is cool. Similar thing with the vocals, seems to have a reversed echo on it. So you get that kind of
yep.
kind of sound like before you start to hear the vocal, which again sounds very dreamy and processed, which is fun. So yeah, I feel like there's still a lot to like in what they've done, and I can certainly appreciate what they've done for it. I was wondering whether or not there was any parity between this track and the logbook, because the first page of the logbook is all about that person who's wandering blind in the dark and then tries to create the world, basically some kind of like god complex thing. And there's a lot of lyrics in this about being blind, about being in the center of the universe and being stuck. And I was wondering whether or not there was some kind of link there, or whether or not that was provable. Or
it's a good call. I'm not sure. My impression has always been that the logbook was entirely kind of independently written and then handed in as a package. But I could be wrong. I'm sure they were all hanging out together and discussing these things in Ladbroke Grove pubs. It could well be something that's connected. It's the only one on the album that is, if so. And it segues then into quite the mood change with We Took the Wrong Step Years Ago. Never a truer word, I think.
Yeah, if by Years Ago was the first album, I would completely agree. This track feels, again, kind of familiar in the sound. For me, there's something about that kind of guitar that just instantly soothes me in a way where I just feel like it feels very familiar, and just like the plucks and the strums. I do like when you can really hear the strums and the picks, it just makes it feel very visceral. They've recorded this where it feels like there's a microphone right next to the guy's hands, and you can just like feel it being played, which I really like. I like the echo and the acousticness of it. The synths almost sound like seagulls. Either that or they do have seagulls in the effect bank somewhere, but again, it just helps to add this feeling of just being wistful and contemplative. I can see someone just standing on a beach with this kind of song in their head, just thinking about whatever it is that they're talking about. It feels like almost like Bob Dylan came in and just went, hey, have you guys sort of space folk? You know, I just feel like there's something very odd about this track. It doesn't necessarily feel like it. It feels very incongruous. Even though I quite like it, it's odd, I guess, yeah. To have it.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because for me, the biggest part of this track is something that I didn't even pick up when I was first listening to it, which is the synthesizers and the audio generator. Because without that, it's a very, very lovely 12-string folk ballady song that could live on Led Zeppelin 3, which had a lot of their kind of folky elements to it. But as soon as you add those synthesizers and those swirling, swishy noises behind it, it becomes Hawkwind at that point, and it couldn't be anybody else. And your term of like space folk, it's their own way of doing another genre is to do this, which just shows how important Dick Mick and now on this album, Del Detmar are to creating this kind of sonic universe that Hawkwind live in.
That makes perfect sense. There's something interesting as well, like at the very end of it, it kind of just swings into this minor key where there's a very obvious change in it before it resolves. And for me, I instantly got Stephen Wilson vibes or Opeth vibes from that. And I felt like, oh yeah, this is again where that kind of psyche inspiration comes from. You could just sample that little bit and tell me it was from an Opeth record, and I would 100% believe you.
Yeah.
That idea of that kind of sinister, this twang, and that last note, which is a real dissonant, which is then resolved, just helps you just keep you on edge. So it's interesting that that's heard here, at least for me, probably for the first time before I start to hear it in more contemporary work.
That's interesting that you picked that up, because actually this is Stephen Wilson's favourite Hawkwind album, and one of his favourite albums, basically. I've seen a few lists of his, you know, top 10 albums, things like this, and this is generally in it. So, yeah, maybe it was influential on him. And it moves into quite a strange track, which is Adjust Me, which I have to say, before you get into it, the interesting thing here for me is that when I picked this album out of the collection and started playing it a lot about 5-6 years ago, from kind of out of nowhere, it had been in the collection for a long time, put it on and you get that kind of, oh, I know this is great, and I remember this and I remember that, and without looking at the sleeve notes, I kind of knew what was coming next. And then Adjust Me came on and I had absolutely no memory of it being on this album or what it was. And it starts definitely in a kind of, well, what is this, where's this come from? And it was like hearing some new unearthed track. It was really, really weird. I'd somehow blanked this from my memory completely. And do love it, but do particularly to what you've been talking about through this album. Love the start.
I think for me, the beginning of the track actually doesn't grab me massively, but the meditative desert vibes afterwards really work. It's weird. It feels like it has some of the stuff which I liked from previous tracks, but again, like just then scrambled. Incidentally, I really like the fact that you are also listening to these and discovering things. I'm glad it's not just me.
No, absolutely.
It's not just me saying stuff and you going, yeah, I know. So it's nice that you're listening to that as well. That's cool. It was interesting again because the lyrics talk about being blind again. I feel like that's a recurring theme, even though I'm not 100% sure what that's achieving, but it is. It talks about androids. I think the androids are wanting to be adjusted. Again, to what end, I'm not sure, whether or not they want to be improved, whether or not they're bored about being the guidance for the blind human race, or if they're trying to do something. I don't know, there's lots of stuff it could be. But yeah, the Adjust Me, which then gets repeated and then kind of twisted, I did not see coming. So yeah, it's a strange one. I prefer it probably more compared to We Took the Wrong Step, just because I like that kind of experimentation, even though it's not a track which I think is my favourite on the album. I like it that it's there. It does, for me, ruin the vibe of the entire listening experience up to that point by the fact that it does that stupid speed up at the very end, which is a bit like the Motorhead effect they did in the first album, which I really do not care for, and it always takes me out of it, which is really annoying.
Fair, and it's funny that we actually come at this track almost from opposite ends, because I love the opening. I love the first minute or two of this, and I don't not like the rest of it, but I'm treading water a little bit, whereas you actually like that bit. So it's interesting that we don't always sync up on these things. And we come out of this to the final track, which is Children of the Sun.
I feel it's fine. I find it quite forgettable. Like, even now, just trying to remember it, I'm like, I know it happens, but I can't quite place it. Again, the acoustic guitar is nice. I feel like, it's fine. It's there. It's perfectly fine. I'm going to keep saying fine. It's just fine.
I love the guitar riff on this, that acoustic guitar riff. Again, apparently, it was just a popular riff of the time, and they've just kind of co-opted it, made a song out of it. But I find that very catchy.
I would say making a song out of it is giving them more credit than I would, because, again, I feel like it's around for a few minutes, and then it just does that long fade out that's, again, a very anticlimactic way of finishing the album. I was hoping for some kind of you shouldn't do that return or something to end big, or even like the way that they end the you know, you're only dreaming, just a way which feels like it was ending on purpose. I don't know why, if that's just a bugbear for me, but I like albums that end on purpose, because I feel like if you're going to spend time putting together a listening experience for an hour, then the way it finishes is important. I think sometimes it's a bit of a curse of this time. I know, just even like with radio edits of tracks that I have from this era, it just fades out on a repeat of the chorus, and I'm like, what the hell are you doing? I don't know if that was just like on Vogue or something, but I just find it monumentally frustrating. So it's a shame that this track is the track that it ends on, but it's fine. I will say fine one more time. Fine.
I'm definitely more positive on this one than you are. So I've been reading the Joe Banks book, Hawkwind, Days of the Underground, Radical Escapism in the Age of Paranoia. And he has so many amazing things to say. You could easily spend like a 5-hour podcast just reading bits out. But there's just one paragraph he writes about Children of the Sun, which, having read it, I thought we should read this one out, because it's really interesting where he comes to. So he goes, "And we're back on Earth with a perky acoustic intro to welcome Starfarers home. Except something's wrong, the finger-picking soon turning into a somber agrarian death march. Children of the Sun is a song suffering from severe cognitive dissonance. The lyrics celebrate flower children basking in the glory of a new day. The golden age of the future comes, where freedom reigns on minds of peace. But Turner delivers them in a bombed-out drawl, with the primitive backing trudges on remorselessly. We are the children of the sun, and this is our inheritance, becomes a dismal wail of resignation. Less hippies enjoying an endless summer, more survivors in a post-apocalyptic landscape, hacking away at the barren ground," end quote. And that there is the Hawkwind that I love. Survivors in a post-apocalyptic wasteland, hacking at the barren ground. Seems like a perfect way to end an album. So that kind of concludes the music of the album. Obviously, we tend to look for your standout track to go into the Hawk Binge Master playlist. I think I know where we're headed with this, but which is the track that stands out for you that you would refer back to?
For me, the track which I do keep coming back to and I really still enjoy listening to and will continue to listen to after this podcast is finished is You Know You're Only Dreaming. I think for me, it's interesting as a piece. I like the refrain, I like the musicality of it. I think it avoids that kind of instrument babble, so I'm happy with that. I like the fact that this gives me faith that Hawkwind know how to end a track eventually. And I feel like I can hear in it inspiration which rings out even to this day. And that's something which I'm really valuing in this sonic exploration that we are doing. So yeah, You Know You're Only Dreaming will be added to the playlist.
It's an excellent choice, sir. I think a welcome addition to any playlist, and it is one of the best tracks on the album, definitely. It's hard to imagine a Hawkwind Master playlist without Master of the Universe, but I think the thing about our Master playlist is that it's not a the best of Hawkwind or Hawkwind's greatest hits. It's the tracks that leap out at you as first time engager with this music. So totally valid. We may or may not add other tracks around these, but this is definitely the Hawkwind playlist for the new listener and therefore completely valid.
Thank you. I feel validated.
That's my job. So that's the music. But as we said at the top of this episode, this is a quite comprehensive package and not just the music. This is seems like the summation of that concept that we felt that they were building towards during the recording of the album, that they then have this wait for the next one kind of a feel, which takes us into the packaging, which is designed by Barney Bubbles. And Barney Bubbles is an interesting character who actually goes on to be cover designer for the likes of The Damned, Elvis Costello, Ian Dury and the Blockheads. He directs videos for the likes of The Specials. So he goes on to have quite the career and be quite influential. And is definitely, he's made his mark here. He's thought of as one of the forefathers of album artwork in this kind of conceptual way. You were saying before that you really liked it.
I do. I think that it looks considered. It looks designed. There's a nice symmetry to it. That I love the colours. I really appreciate the thought, which looks like it's gone into it. I think the kind of the wings, like this, there's almost something 1930s German about it, in that kind of like almost like, or that kind of like Roman SPQR kind of hawk that it has. So there's like, again, that feeling of like possible threat or possible authoritarianism, but then within that hawk there is this star child who is looking at peace, and that's very, I feel like, very rainbowy and 70s. But again, even within her, I think it's a her, within that there is then this triangle, which you do see in the logbook, has that kind of Illuminati feeling to it as well. So I do feel like there's a lot to process within it, that idea of a kind of interesting like entropy of concepts all being smashed together, but being like held in space by these almost like UN kind of stars all around it. So yeah, I feel like there's lots of playing of the idea of systems, of authority, of entity, but then also some kind of idea of the soul, but then almost maybe some kind of like extra potential sinister contrivance which is holding the whole thing together.
It's fascinating that you pick out that 1930s kind of Roman general eagle type character that you see a lot of, because Hawkwind actually do go graphically right down that route based in a few albums' time. So there will come a time when we will look at some album artwork and definitely refer back to this conversation. I always wonder at times like this whether the designer knew what was coming musically, whether this was like a symbiotic thing or whether it was just independently designed, because it does just feel like such a match for the music. Interestingly, on the back cover of the album is a quote which is quite famous in Hawkwind lore. "Technicians of Spaceship Earth, this is your captain speaking. Your captain is dead." Which means you finally know why I say Technicians of Spaceship Earth at the top of this podcast. I'm glad that that happens on album 2 rather than album 25, because otherwise you'd have spent a long time wondering where on earth that comes from.
I really like that phrase. That phrase is deeply evocative.
It is, isn't it?
I think the idea of this, of Spaceship Earth, is an interesting idea. I think I've heard it explored before, but the idea of this is your captain speaking, your captain is dead, just feels like a deeply sinister phrase, which I feel like could be incorporated into any kind of sci-fi horror film. It feels very Event Horizon or something, which I really like. So yeah, I think it's a fantastic line. I really appreciate it.
And it has umlauts all over it. Apparently it's one of the first signs of the heavy metal umlaut, as it's called, and made famous by Motorhead, of whom we will hear more later. So while we're talking about copy, that takes us into the Hawkwind logbook, which definitely deserves a bit of investigation on its own right.
Yeah, it's very zine-y to me. Compared to the design of the album, which is very considered, looks very professional, there's drawings and cut-ups and stuff in this logbook which feels a lot more like amateurish
from a graphic point of view.
Yeah, just like, you know, some of the drawing, yep, just feels less considered. It does look like maybe something that I could draw. But it's weird. It has robots. It has strange, melancholic monologues of people trapped in their own minds. I love the fact that actually in the first album, they said that they wanted to freak people in a nice way without acid. And on page 2 of the logbook is a big marijuana leaf. So I feel like, yeah, maybe not acid, but you know, we're not saying without any kind of mental change.
You're absolutely right. And the logbook does go into, you know, is philosophy in there, and occultism is in there, and mysticism is in there, and science fiction is in there. It's quite a melting pot of ideas.
I mean, there is an almost like proto-creation myth in the first story, almost like a new Let There Be Light. Instead of God being a character that wanted to create the world for creating the world's sake, he was trapped and wanted to create reality in order to create a distraction from his own incarceration, which is an interesting, again, way of looking at it. It's patched between these ideas of a mystic voyage, the fact that we learn that they call Hawkwind a spaceship. And that's the first time we get that. I was always wondering where Hawkwind came from. I don't know whether or not they thought it was a spaceship and, you know, when they first called it that, or whether or not they were like, we want a spaceship and we'll just call it Hawkwind because we're called Hawkwind. I don't know. I can't tell. The fact it's two-dimensional is weird. So we're dealing with like different planes of existence, which is, yeah, just kind of super interesting. And it all seems to end in disaster towards the very end, which is where you get the longer version of the recording. Your captain is dead. Your captain is speaking. Your captain is dead. This is your captain speaking. Your captain is dead. They talk about the fact that everything's running out. Time's running out. Love's running out. Blood is running out. Like everything is running out. It feels like a, like something, you know, a mission which is failing step by step, and just literally every way it can fall apart, it is, which then ends at the end, which is obviously very bleak.
It's definitely a theme for lockdown, because the hand sanitizer is running out, toilet roll is running out, bread is running out.
Free Zoom minutes are running out.
So maybe he saw ahead. So Robert Calvert is a writer during the counterculture years. He is putting stories forward to science fiction magazines. He's becomes a very good friend of Michael Moorcock, who again becomes a big influence on the band. And Calvert does go on to be a major, major figure in Hawkwind lore, as we said at the top of the show. So definitely a name to listen out for. And some of the writing in the logbook actually resurfaces as spoken word pieces on other albums for Hawkwind. So this definitely has some mileage in it. So that is the package. Interestingly, I have the logbook in my vinyl copy of In Search of Space, but actually managed to find online a PDF of the logbook, which is really nicely done, which is what Matt used to read through. And we will post the URL of this with the rest of the notes we put out on our social channels, so that if you don't have it, you can go and check it out in all its glory. So that was In Search of Space. Definitely an epic search it was too. We would love to hear what you think of In Search of Space. In fact, I know what quite a lot of people thought of Search in Space, because in the book that we tend to refer to for outside opinions, Hawkwind Fans Worldwide Facebook Top 40 Albums by Elric Newby, this album came in at number 8, which actually is somewhat lower than I thought it was going to come in to. I would have had it top 3 probably for me, but it means that there are 7 others, or 6 probably, because one of their live albums that we will come to, we will address, is above it. We'd love to know what you think of it. If you love it as much as me, if you see some of the different angles in it that Matt found, or if you think that we are both horribly wrong, all opinions are welcome within reason. Matt, where can they do this?
So we are very active on Instagram and Twitter. At Hawkbinge is the handle for both of those. And if you want to send us anything more long form, you can find our email address at podcast@hawkbinge.space.
Excellent. And we would ask a favor of you, if you've enjoyed this, if you're coming along for the ride, then please do leave us a review, give us a 5-star rating. It will really help. We're a fledgling podcast. It'll help us turn up more in some search terms and spread the word of the Church of Hawkwind. And if you didn't enjoy it, then lie through your teeth. Give us a glittering review and a 5-star rating anyway. That's enough pleading, I think, for one week.
Well pled.
We will be back, as Hawkwind will be back, with the third album, Do Re Mi Fa Sol La Ti Do, not to be confused with Do Re Mi Fa Sol La Ti Do, who plays on the wing for Real Madrid. This was In Search of Space. Hawkwind went in search of space. They found it, and they found that it's deep.
Time, 0300 hours. Day, 9th of April, 1946. Position, unknown. We have been through so many time storms and warps in the fabric of reality that the purpose of our journey has long been lost to memory. Even our computers no longer speak with any certainty of the past. But we still journey on through space in search of the present, leaving a trail of abandoned futures in our wake.